righty. Sarah, I guess you're up first.
All right.
All righty. Thank you, Sarah. Do an introduction for yourself as well along the way.
All right. So I am a researcher with the Northern Research Station, and I focus on the social issues of fire management. And before I start, if you guys wanted to comment, I've been noticing that the messaging on the wildfire on smoke is really good. I was wondering why, and now I know. At least I noticed from Chicago that they were doing a good job of talking about smoke. So I do research on social issues of fire management, and I sort of have a broad overview of social research, and I've been doing a synthesis on smoke with Joint Fire Science, so I'm going to talk from a fairly high up level. And one of the first points is that there isn't actually a lot of research specific to smoke that has been done. There's actually been a huge amount of social research taking place in the Joint Fire Science and National Fire Plan, but very little specific to smoke. There's about one study that has a significant focus on smoke, and there's another study where there's 1 to 3 questions related to smoke, usually smoke to drive fire. There's been a larger set of questions about fuel management. So what I'm going to focus on is sort of more of a where does smoke fit in our research findings, and a lot of the focus, people's reactions to smoke is related to the reactions to the other fuel management part. So I'm going to hopefully try to situate where things fit. And so part of this is sort of thinking through, we know a lot about communication and how to change behavior and social norms from a variety of fields, social marketing, environmental, and natural hazards. And kind of one of the key points of that is that you need to understand your audience. You need to understand what they're thinking, what they care about, know what they already know, so you're not telling them what they already know. So it's a very fast way to make sure people stop listening. And just understand what they care about. What you think is important may not be what they think is important. And also sort of avoid preconceived notions about what their issues are, then you're targeting your message the wrong way. And so in that light of sort of thinking about the audience, understanding your audience, I'm just going to start off sort of with the general findings about the general audience about fire management. And that is that, you know, there's a lot of preconceived notions, conventional wisdom about the public and fire. And this is meant to get you thinking about who is the audience and what are their issues. And one of the first ones I ever ran into is simply, mostly stop the public to think all fire is bad. But when you look at the research, it's really clear that that's not the case. Certainly with prescribed fire, 80% of people prescribed fire at acceptable management schools. And on ones that have sort of breakdowns, about 30% have strong approval and 50% is qualified. Some of those are qualified on, I'll touch on. And there are some research on wildfire which also shows that people can distinguish between sort of dangerous wildfire and fires that maybe you want to monitor. And there is room for that as well. And there's a lot of demographic conventional wisdom, and I think this is useful to think about when you think about your smoke message, because you don't want to incorporate false conventional wisdom into it. And one of them is simply part of the problem is all the new people moving into wild, woolly areas. And we really don't find on studies the consistent pattern that new residents are less aware or less active in fire mitigation. In some locations they might be, in others, in fact, they're actually the more proactive. And there's two sort of explanations for that dynamic. One is within the United States, 2% of the moves are within a county. So what that says is that most of those new people actually really aren't new to the area, they're just new to that house. So just because they're new to the house doesn't mean they're not familiar with the area. 20% are within the state, and then 20% are from out of the state. And the other one is confirmation bias, which is simply when we form our opinions about something, we tend to give more credibility the information that reinforces that opinion and discount information that contradicts it. So I always like to do the cable news channel phenomenon because the cable news station you think is good and the one that's, you know, absolutely full of crap. And that's kind of the definition of confirmation bias. So what that says, people who are new to an area aren't know their and they are receptive to saying, hey, I don't know what's going on, and oh, you're doing prescribed fire, why are you doing that, and that sort of thing. whereas people who've lived in a place for a long time are likely to have formed an opinion, and when they start getting new information, if it doesn't fit their opinion, they're likely to discount them. So new people often can be actually more progressive than people who have lived in a place for a long time. Another one is that part-time people are less likely to get the fire risk than full-time. Again, no consistent evidence that they are less likely to get the fire risk. If they're sort of less proactive, either in doing defensible space or supporting prescribed fire, it's more a time issue. I'm here on weekends. I don't want to spend it in vegetation management. I am here for 2 weeks on my vacation. I really don't want to have to deal with smoke from it on my vacation. So it's not an understanding issue. It's just sort of a practical time issue. That people don't take responsibility is one of the common ones I've heard lately. How do we get the public to take more responsibility for their role? And we really find that actually, no, the public does take responsibility, but they see it as a sense of shared responsibility. So they recognize, I chose to live out here, this is my property, it's my job to take care of my land. You know, I don't expect the government to take care of my land, but what they do expect is that the government is going to take care of their land. And so it's like, you're going to ask me to take care of my land, then you can take care of your land. And then also education. Help us understand the risk. Help us understand how to mitigate it. Help us understand what you're doing. And then experience consistent effect. People often think, if I can just get people to, you know, if they experience the fire, oh, that'll be good. They'll be more proactive. They'll understand the risk. And in some people, it will have that effect. In other people, it can actually have a dampening effect. Part of it depends on what that experience was, and part of that depends on the particular person. And finally, there really aren't any clear demographic patterns. People often want to be able to say certain income levels will behave a certain way, certain education levels will behave a certain way, and really there are no, oftentimes there's no significant demographic patterns between the actions and beliefs. And when there are, they're not consistent across studies. The only one that's relatively consistent is gender, and I'll touch on how that affects those as we go. Okay, so what does shape public views? And I'm just going to go to the next slide. You know, and that basically is really simple. Understanding people's acceptance. The more they understand what you're doing, the more they are likely to approve of it. And this applies whether we're talking about prescribed fire, thinning, or defensible state, and even when we're talking about wildfire management. So for one study in Massachusetts, knowledge is the earnings where we start getting into the relationship with smoke. So if they had knowledge, they were less likely concerned about smoke, aesthetics, wildlife issues, concerned about its use in your home. I did research in my village, Nevada, and it had very, very similar. The next one is ecological benefits are particularly important in kind of really the key role, and it's kind of that people aren't really necessarily care as much about fire issues as the natural ecological issues. And one example of that is a study survey in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan. They also did it for states out west with similar findings. And basically, if you ask them what the most important consideration is, really about forest health, it's managing forest for the health. And reducing fire risk is less important. And this, we see this in other studies, that what people really care about are the ecological. And it kind of makes sense because people live out there because they like nature, they want it to be in good shape, it's a positive thing to think about, whereas fire risk is something that some people may not want to think about. It's a probability, it may or may not happen. So it kind of makes sense that the ecological benefits are actually more important to people. In terms of specific to smoke, it does come out in several different studies, the ecological benefits. There was a study where they did California and Michigan, and Florida and Missouri. And in both California and Michigan, believe that prescribed burning improves wildlife conditions in a positive effect. A study in Oregon and actually Washington. Smoke is more acceptable to help forest health. And then a study, a focus group in Washington state, as participants learned more about smoke and prescribed burning and why they were having to put up with the smoke, they became more tolerant of both the prescribed burning and smoke. And that study is particularly useful because one of the groups that they recruited was an anti-smoke group. So it mostly turned into asthma. And even in that group, as people became more tolerant of smoke, or that they became more tolerant to smoke the more they learned about the ecological benefits. And so understanding is kind of the key dynamic for all fuel management, irrelevant what it is. With prescribed fire, there's two more things that are clearly related to acceptance, and one is escape. So concern about escape is something significant in both study and all four states, and related to acceptance. And then there's a focus group study of 5 different locations out west, and in that one they asked that people, how would you feel if agencies started doing more burning? And the first reaction was generally no, and then it was, but why? They can't control it, and that's usually somebody in each of the focus groups would speak up and say, but I think most of us go fine. And so they would have a discussion, and then they would conclude, yes, actually, I think most of us do go fine, and when I think about it that way, I'm not opposed to doing more prescribed burning. I just need to understand that most of us go right. You need to tell us about the ones that go right. And if you look at those two quotes, you see that they're kind of comfortable with a 5 or 10% paper, which is much higher than actually did. And smoke. So smoke is the other one, not surprisingly. But the key thing with smoke is it's really fundamentally a health issue. And that's where it's what matters. It's a health problem for a third of households. And I first saw this study where I had a survey, had a question, is there someone in your house who has a smoke issue, a health issue affected by smoke? I knew the number would be 28 to 36%. And I checked with a demographer, and it actually does work out that roughly a third of households in the United States have somebody who has asthma or chronic pulmonary disease or bronchitis that would be affected by smoke. So for those people, it's really scary, and it's going to be very important to them. But as you look at others, as you look through the research, what you see is for those people, it's really important. But for the rest of the people, it's not necessarily that important. It's generally not seen as a reason to not use prescribed fire for smoke. And for most people, other concerns are more important than smoke. And one demonstration from a study in California of Lodge's fire surrogate site, where people did tours of their different treatments, and after the tour we gave them a survey and asked them for their preferences, and then we asked them to rate how important different variables were in determining their preferences. And so in this chart you're looking at, the lower the bar, the more important it was. And as you can see, managing for forest health and reducing fire risk was the clear, the most important issue that people took into consideration. Next, you had improving wildlife habitat, erosion potential, cost effectiveness. You're still not coming into smoke. So where is smoke? Well, hopefully it'll show on the screen, but smoke is important to all of these. Coming in after recreational opportunities, after scenic quality, all these variables actually on average were more important to people than smoke management. Now, the manager I dealt with on this looked at that result and said, our data was wrong. That's not who he dealt with. He dealt with people over smoke issues, not recreation, not potential wood products. And when you look at the distribution, not to me, it was very much of a bimodal distribution. With 30% rating it as very, somewhat the very important, everybody else far over on the right of not at all important. So there are 2 longitudinal studies, and what that means is that they resurveyed the same population twice. They give us some interesting findings on smoke. There was one in Utah where they had done a survey in an area where they had an escape prescribed fire in the Cascades to burn. And so they went in and resurveyed the same people after the fire to see how that had affected their general attitude. And what they found that was general, it actually hadn't affected a lot of their attitude. But honestly, what it did was they found that prescribed fire was still acceptable. So it didn't make people say, no, flat out, you can't do it. But it did increase their concern about smoke and whether it was being managed well. Even then, only 30% said smoke made it unacceptable management. And then there's a survey in Oregon and Washington State that was done in 1996 and repeated in 2000. And in those places, that study, they actually did find decreasing sort of acceptance towards smoke issues. With more people said it was a health issue for people in their household, and less people said it was acceptable, it results in a healthier forest. But you can still see that healthier forest idea is in there, and it's still acceptable to the majority of people. The authors hypothesize that the reason why this is the work for is because there's a lot more burning. And the question I have on this is what kind of education communication program they had in school. I suspect that probably they were not doing a lot of explaining about why they were doing, why people were getting more. So the next one, the next parts I'm going to talk about are really just very few studies that sort of give an indication of. We don't have really strong findings on any of the next states, but they're patterns that we didn't see. One is sort of there is a general attitude by both people who live in wildfire areas and people who don't, that those of you who live in your natural areas, you are not willing to live with them. It's an acknowledgement that it's a natural part of the landscape. Need to learn how to live with it. There is an indication there's a preference for using mechanical harvest in the wildland urban interface by fire in more rural areas. But it's not a completely consistent preference. This is from a recent study we did in Oregon and Utah. And what you see is that actually prescribed fire around neighborhoods is pretty much as acceptable as prescribed fire in remote areas. And from the experience, the green ones, Oregon A and B, Utah B, are all three locations that have been directly affected by fire recently. They had to evacuate, and the fire has come fairly near to their community. In the case of Utah B, it's actually burned through part of it. And they still saw prescribed fire around neighborhoods as quite large and acceptable action. They do seem to be, there are indications that they understand long-term trade-offs, so there's a general willingness to tolerate smoke now. They think it needs less smoke down the road. It sense that smoke from prescribed fire can be damaged. And they can have warnings. So particularly for people who have health issues, they can get a warning and make arrangements to, we will not have the family picnic on that Saturday, or I can go stay at my cousin's out of town, because they can have warning ahead of time. So there is indications that sort of that sense of the smoke can be managed is good, one of the others. But one of the questions is what the tolerance level is for when the White House study was really interesting because that shows that the source of smoke can matter. So for the anti-smoke group, they basically became tolerant of smoke from prescribed fire because smoke, ecological benefits accrue to everybody. I care about the forest. I can put up with smoke because it's a service and something I care about. Whereas in Washington State, and they felt they had a lot of agricultural burning smoke, and the point of view then was, no, that's not okay, and I shouldn't have to put up with it, it's just the farmer who's benefiting from that. And finally, there are some studies that do show the group differences in terms of demographics. There's one national study that basically does show that in terms of efficacy and rate, there are differences in perceptions of fire management, including higher levels of concern for African. And in general, that pattern held for all of our management issues. Happens to nurse, most nurse, static death, and foundation about smoke and all those other things. And then two studies did find women were more concerned about smoke than men. Two studies sort of directly look at wildfire smoke. One found that people were less willing to accept less aggressive responses if it contributed to poor air quality. So they wanted suppression. More if they felt if there was an indication they were going to have worse air to do that. And then there was another study looking at recreational vacation plans, and basically it did show that smoke led over a third of vacationers to either say, I'm going to go to the hotel or I'm just not going to make a trip. So it did have a significant impact on vacation planning. So the final thing that comes into play with prescribed burning that probably affects smoke too is trust. And this is sort of the two things that affect shape acceptance of all fuel management is understanding and do you trust the guy who's doing it. One example is most study basically trust which is a predictor of approval of whatever treatment it was in all four sites. Missouri has the highest trust level and it also has the largest effect on attitudes there. So basically it sort of boils down to treatments are generally acceptable if they're done by knowledgeable people. I know they know what they're doing, preferably local. People really do care that people are local, familiar with the area. They can assist with it's related to trust. They can say understand the issues in the landscape better. So the practices are established, people understand it. because people are doing it to come into life at the time. I like to kind of rephrase it to being about sort of respect, and people are very willing to respect the expertise of management. You guys know what you're doing your job, but they'll only give that respect if their point of view and their clarity forms the perspective. So if the fact that they have a child with asthma is being respected, and so that makes them have a big care about issues. If that's being respected, they're much more likely to give respect. And it's sort of one demonstration of the importance of trust is from that study and sort of the trust levels in agency managers to use a particular management practice. And this is kind of the key thing with trust. It's not trust in the agency. It's trust in the individual who is doing it. The only one that was predictive of acceptance was trust in the agency managers on a particular practice. So general trust did not predict acceptance. The trust for that particular practice by a particular agency people did. And just and so finally, this is sort of give you an idea, summarized from the vote at all with your study. You can see what is significantly related to acceptance and described burning. The key variables are really, do they have a positive attitude about it? Do they trust the agency who's implementing it? And is it something that's personally important to them? And then outcome belief, escape is really clearly negatively related. Cost effectiveness is actually more important in three locations than most of the other things. Does this is a cost-effective way to manage the United States. Wildlife and smoke was only really significantly related in the third. So it gives you kind of an idea of all the different factors that come into play besides smoke and shaping acceptance. So caveat, local context always matters, taking into account the history, what's gone on before, not directly related to smoke, but in Michigan, near the Mack Lake fire. We did a survey 20 years after the Mack Lake fire, and they still didn't like the transfer because of that fire, or it's largely attributed to that fire. Topography, there's indications in some focus groups that people take that into account, places with inversion. Maybe a lot less tolerance of smoke because they have to put up with it more. One location in the, people said, part of the, what really annoys us is, we get smoke, we get an inversion, we get smoke, and it's not even smoke from here. Smoke from the other side of here. Other people. So this is a picture to me of a successful program. This is in Pine Village, Nevada. You know that area. Every single one of those dots is a house worth probably over $1 million. And no one in the town complained about that fire. Very dramatic fire, smoke. In fact, in that town, there's a guy who lives at the bottom of a little valley where they have public land above it. So the smoke's always going to come down and gather at his house. And they've talked with him a lot. And they had one summer when they actually were doing burning. And he called up and said, hey, I'm not getting enough smoke. What's up with that? So it's possible. So finally, this is from a study where at the end of the focus group, we asked people to give advice to the Forest Service. And I think the first one, which is the dominant response, is kind of a good message for thinking about your smoke messaging. Is that if you tell us who you are, what you do, and why you're doing it, you would actually really, really like to know. And then the fact that they do appreciate the work being done, they do appreciate being asked what they do. They do want decision to make the science, and they want people to listen to the local. And the agency. So I think that's pretty much it. Those are two documents that have not so much about smoke, but general relevant information. I don't know if we're doing questions here or if we're going to do all the presentations and then the discussion.
I guess the question for the organizers of the presenters, do we have time to do questions in between or if we want to do it at the end? Just out of respect for time.
I've budgeted 3 hours, so.
Okay. I want to keep the roll going then, and the presentations. If folks hold their questions, that's fine. If you have to get up and you're not going to get your question heard because of other obligations, I'm happy to interrupt the session and do a question real quick. Just to focus the opportunity to get those in. All right. Okay. Scroll. Next one. Laura, member of the book.
I am, and I'm with the Nature Conservancy. And let's see. I think I'm showing my screen, and from the beginning.
Do there's about a couple of people joined us that haven't announced themselves by any chance. Looks like an actual presentation. Okay.
All right, well, I'll go ahead. And my talk actually really compliments Sarah's, although I get at it from a different way, and I'm not a researcher. I'm a policy person, and what I'm going to share today is a set of results from three different public opinion surveys. Most of you probably know public opinion surveys as polls. So those things you get at dinner time if your phone is listed and the questions you get asked. And I'm going to talk about one from 2008 that was a national survey, and then two recent ones, one done in Santa Fe this spring and another just recently completed in Southern Oregon. The well, and just a moment of background here, the Nature Conservancy uses a lot of public opinion surveys, and we do them because they're very rapid, and first, they help us know where the starting line is in terms of where people's thinking is before we start our any kind of communications work, and I believe Sarah also made this same exact point. We also use the public opinion surveys to test messages and figure out what words are going to work for us to get our communication across. And this is kind of the whack-a-mole theory of communications, meaning that if you want to win the big prize, you know, you could bounce your mallet all over the place, but if you just pick one hole and keep pounding it, eventually the mole's going to come up and you're going to win the prize. And same thing with communication about figuring out what words work and then using your messages. The first national poll was done in 2008 as part of the Partners in Fire Education, and I think if my review of who's on the call is correct, Helene and Ed were both involved in this. I think the rest of you maybe haven't seen this material before, which is a good thing because it's kind of old material, but hopefully it's still relevant. And Partners in Fire Education brought together Nature Conservancy with DOI agencies, Forest Service, and a bunch of partners led by a steering committee of 30 people that all helped us create first a set of focus groups and then a national poll of 800 samples and then three subsample polls, one in Southern California, one in grassland states, and one in forested states. And we had really two goals, getting a baseline of public attitudes towards fire because this was the first national public opinion poll that had been conducted, and secondly, we had a goal of gaining acceptance or understanding what kinds of messages to use to gain acceptance about the ecological role of fire. It was 2008. Appropriate management response was something people were thinking about, and you'll see a little bit in the results that I go through, a little bit of the kind of lingering effects of that particular time period. Okay, I'm going to quickly go through the findings. I'm going to move these slides really quick, and I actually need to adjust the bar. I hope I can figure out how to close it. I don't want to leave the webinar, though, because I can't see my full screen. Okay, well, I'll just make do. So first, where is the public regarding fire? What we learned is that they're way more sophisticated in their understanding of the fire story than we anticipated at the start of the project. That gets at Sarah's point about the misconceptions, actually. Now it doesn't want to move down. Okay, secondly, we learned that there is a strong recognition that some fires can be beneficial. So we asked this question as part of the polls, are some fires in natural areas beneficial, and who agrees and who disagrees? And we found that really there was a majority of overall support and a really strong set of responses where people strongly agree with the statement. Now, to a lesser extent, we found that a majority of people also believed that a history of fire suppression has led to more destructive fires, and so we asked this question, do you agree that putting out all fires in natural areas can create conditions that will make later fires burn faster, hotter, and more out of control? And we also found some pretty good support for this statement, although not as much as the one that I showed you previously. On the question of where is the public regarding fire, by and large, fire equals danger for most people. There's a really strong emotional context that has to be recognized in all communication efforts. And I think it's different during prescribed fire season than it is during wildfire season. And I happen to be in New Mexico, not very far away from the West Conscious fire that's burning toward Los Alamos, and the fear in town is very strong, and you know, it's a direct correlation. When we did focus groups, we learned that there's a whole set of emotions that describe what people feel when they're thinking about fire. And we also then repeated a forced choice question from a prior national survey in 2004 to see if people's views had changed, because there were a significant number of large fires from 2004 to 2008. So our, quote, natural statement was, forest fires are a part of nature. We need to protect communities from fires, but in remote areas, we should let fires burn and let nature take its course. Or dangerous, the statement being forest fires are unpredictable and dangerous. We need to contain and extinguish fire as soon as they are discovered. And we found only a slight shift in attitudes between 2004 and 2008, with more people feeling that fire was dangerous than natural, but the margin of error in this poll is around 5%. So, you know, not that significantly tipped toward dangerous. This view was really consistent across the geographic audiences that we interviewed. What you see here are the four subgroups that we had as part of the poll. Our third perception is that people are thinking that fire danger is getting worse. And we asked, in repeating the questions from 2004 to 2008, are fires worse than they were 5 years ago, not as bad as 5 years ago, or about the same? And we found that more people in 2008 thought that fires were worse than they were 5 years ago than they did back in 2004. Fourth point about where the public is that in the grand scheme of things, fire tends to be a much more minor concern than other conservation issues. And here you can see the various things that we asked them about: global warming at the top of the list, uncontrollable wildfires that destroy property and forests in rather the middle, and smoke from fires in natural areas at the bottom. This also fits exactly with what Sarah had to say, with 34% of people saying it was a concern, but only 16% saying it was extremely or very serious, and I'm talking about the smoke line. All right, so then we went on and explained a set of policy approaches that will be familiar to you all. This is so that you can then understand what we did in terms of messaging. So we tested some approaches to fire to gauge public support for each one. We read them this statement about government agencies, conservation organizations, and private industries considering using certain approaches to handling fires in natural areas in order to help prevent large, severe fires and restore forests and other natural areas to balanced health. Then we read them some statement. The first one was, allow fire teams to use controlled burns when and where doing so will safely reduce the amount of fuel for fires. And we found 52% strongly support and 90% total support. The second statement we read them was, cut and remove overgrown brush and trees in natural areas that act as fuel for fires, and we found 51% strong support and 79% total support. The third one was, we read the statement, allow naturally started fires that do not threaten homes, people, or the health of that natural area to take their natural course rather than putting the fire out. 31% strong support, 62% total support, so not nearly as strong as the previous two that I shared with you. Now, the language in these that we used to describe these approaches to fire was carefully constructed and was really critical. So, for example, mechanical thinning is described in everyday terms, which people can understand, the phrase cut and remove overgrown brush and trees. And secondly, a rationale for the action was made explicit, since it explains that this overgrowth can act as fuel for fires. Sarah, I didn't plan this, but this really supports one of your points about people wanting to understand what's going on, and the more they know, the more likely they are to agree. This language was really carefully tested. So there are four key things in this sentence: allow fire teams to use controlled burns when and where doing so will safely reduce the amount of fuel for fires. So fire teams. People want to know that a team of people, forest experts, firefighters, and weather experts are working together to decide when and where fires can be conducted safely. They don't want an individual to be making this decision alone. Safety, I think everybody already knows about the importance of that in the public's mind. Burn, seen as a word, burn is seen as smaller, less wild, and more able to be controlled than a fire. And then when and where, our focus group respondents saw many variables as potentially leading to out-of-control fires, and they want those many factors considered. So when you insert when and where into your sentences, you're implying that it's been considered. Somebody's not on mute. Just having made that mistake once myself, I'd like it to be pointed out. All right, so instead, two key phrases have risen to the top, and we looked at controlled burn, managed burn, proactive burn, and prescribed burn. And when you looked at it nationally, you can see here prescribed burn was really not favored as a term, and controlled burn was very much favored. Now, these results definitely circulated in the interagency fire community in 2008, and a decision was made to stick with prescribed burn, and I completely understand that. I did want to show this slide so that you have the information, and when you feel comfortable using a term like managed burn or controlled burn in your communications, it's a good idea, although I understand it's not going to be we're not going to make a decision as an interagency fire community to completely change the language, and that's fine. Why? Okay, people simply want to feel taken care of when it comes to fire. They want to know that someone is in charge and vigilant. And with the term prescribed, they question whether they were getting the right medicine. Here's a quote from a focus group. You know, when I look at those words, controlled and managed, they're also words that you see in your hierarchy of status and in employment. And I think you look at that as a situation being taken care of. Again, the proactive steps are also seen as being the most effective approaches to preventing large and severe fires. So here are the three statements again: allow fire teams to use controlled burns, cut and remove overgrown brush and trees, and allow naturally started fires that do not threaten homes, people, or the health of that natural area to take their natural course. And you can see, again, how those rated out in terms of people's responses of effectiveness. And then we asked about messages. And we had a series of 10 statements. I'm not going to go through all of them, but we did find some really strong consistency in responses to the messages across the four geographic areas. And our number one message was a safety one. The message being safety is always the number one priority when it comes to fire, but by putting out every single fire, we are actually creating more dangerous conditions. Using controlled burns to thin out overgrowth and carefully managing natural fires helps ensure the safety of neighborhoods in outlying areas, and 43% found this very convincing, meaning they might change their behavior or change their opinion. Lesson two, focusing on the human element, gave us messages that people responded better to. Here's an example. Forests and natural areas are important to our health. They act as natural filters to give us clean air and are the source of our clean drinking water. We must ensure the health of our forests and natural areas by allowing some fires to take their natural course. Here you can see the AMR theme that was going on for us at the time. And then lesson number three, people do value the health of natural areas, particularly those places near them. And we learned that in 2008, people still remembered the Yellowstone fire from 1988. So we gave them the statement, we know that allowing fire to take its natural course can help the health of our forests and natural areas. For example, the fires in Yellowstone in 1988 showed how natural areas can quickly bounce back, rejuvenated with even more wildlife and types of plants than ever before, and 45% of people found this to be a very convincing argument. A few other key lessons. One is about technical language. You know, we have our own language. Here are three terms I chose to put up here that the public doesn't understand. And we know that we have substitutes, so we can talk about natural areas or homes near natural areas instead of wildland urban interface. We can talk about the fire team instead of an incident command team. And we can talk about cutting and removing overgrown brush and trees instead of mechanical treatment. We also learned that the fear factor is there, and it really doesn't work to our advantage if we try to confront it directly. So in communications where we say it's natural that people are often scared of fire and do not want to risk damage to their homes, or we cannot consign our wild areas to a slow death because we are afraid to let them go through their natural life cycles, these messages don't really work because they tap into that fear factor instead of reassuring and providing structure, safety, control, management, etc. The tough love approach, the thought that, you know, if you don't reduce the fuels around your home, then your home isn't going to make it next time is also, it's a tough to have your message heard when you're approaching it that way. Intellectually, people realize that firefighters may not be able to save every home, but they really want people to try. So here you see a statement we read, during large severe fires near homes, there are times when firefighters may have to let a home burn if no lives are at risk. And people strongly agree with that, especially in the grassland oversample. However, that does not mean that they don't want someone to try to save every home. And this is a photo I just picked up yesterday from the Wall of Fire that I thought was really sweet, and it explains the sentiment that people have. Finally, messengers, who are the best spokespeople, and really it's firefighters on the line, even if that's not officially what your day job is. If you're a communicator, if you look like a firefighter, then in the public's mind, you are convincing. And it applies for wildland as well as prescribed fire situations. So not much about smoke in this poll, really just that one little bit. And the next one I'm going to show is from a Santa Fe poll done by the same pollsters and done just recently in March. And we focused a little bit more on smoke in this poll because we had a strong need to. But the poll itself was actually about something a little different, which I will explain as I go through, just so you can understand the context. Okay, don't need to see the method so much. First, we asked about general attitudes on water and fire in Santa Fe. And I want you to see this slide here where we asked people first right off the bat, what do you think of the job the Forest Service is doing, the City of Santa Fe Water Division is doing, and the governing body. And you can see really strong support for the job that the Forest Service is doing. And I actually didn't have the slide in, and when Sarah showed her slide about trust, I went and pulled this and put it in here because you can already see that we're starting at a place where the people who responded to this poll trust the Forest Service and approve of the job that's being done. Next, we asked about what are you generally concerned about. We had the whole list of things here, public education, global warming at the top. Again, we asked whether smoke from controlled burns in forests around Santa Fe was a problem, and we found 5% thought that was extremely serious, 7% very serious, 34% somewhat serious, and I note that this poll was done about 4 months after an event where, well, maybe 6 months after an event where an error in a prescribed fire resulted in 2 evenings of very intense smoke in the city of Santa Fe. So, you know, these are actually pretty good responses considering that event. People remembered it, but they, for the most part, weren't overly concerned about it. Okay, so in fact, people are more alarmed about the threat of drought than they are about forest fire. Now, we tested some language, and it's a little bit complicated, but essentially the first paragraph was about the risk that forest fires pose to Santa Fe's water supply, and then we asked people, we described to them a water fund that we were proposing to set up that would collect money from water users, directly and put that into a fund that would pay for 50% of the cost of the land treatments, mostly prescribed burns, some mechanical treatment in the watershed in order to keep it healthy over the long run, and to give the Forest Service some budget relief by having the city actually pay directly for some of the land treatments that provide water. So that was the idea here, and we found overwhelmingly voters supported this water fund, with 43% strongly supporting and 76% total support. We were really happy with that, and I want to pull out a few things from the communications and messaging that relate directly to smoke. So we read them these two statements. Controlled burns use well-established forestry practices that scientists, firefighters, foresters, and environmentalists agree have proven to be the safest and most effective way to manage the forest and prevent damaging wildfires. And we had 75% support for that. No, I don't know that I can read this. It's too small on my screen. Sorry, you're just going to have to read the one on the right to yourself. Essentially, it's the anti-controlled burn statement, and it's too dangerous, and we shouldn't have that kind of policy. And that was really not supported in this community. We had a set of messages that we tested, like the other one. We were trying to see what played best, and we found that the Cerro Grande fire, this is ironic given that we're having a repeat of it right now, people remembered it, and this statement, a decade ago, the Cerro Grande fire near Los Alamos burned for 2 weeks, leaving behind a wasteland of destroyed homes, dead trees, and ash. Debris and ash clogged streams, rivers, and lakes, causing over $9 million in damage to the Los Alamos water supply. We cannot let that happen in Santa Fe, and this is our most compelling message. We also had a public health message that was that rated out pretty well as well, and that is the trees in our forests filter our air and water to keep them clean and healthy. The forests around Santa Fe are critical to our public health, and the Santa Fe Water Fund will protect the forest and our water. We have an opposition statement, and that directly ties to smoke. So we read to people this statement. Opponents say this plan is expensive and unnecessary. Our water supply has never been harmed by forest fires before, and the solution that has been proposed, which involves intentionally setting small fires in nearby forests, is the wrong approach. Smoke from the fires will be a nuisance and a health risk, and in a worst-case scenario, one of these intentional fires could get out of control and turn into a wildfire, as has happened elsewhere. Water rates in Santa Fe are already too high, and in this economy, Santa Fe families can't afford another fee increase. So we threw every negative reason we could think of into the opposition statement, and you see in this graph that it really didn't change people's opinion. So the first 76% total support before we read them the messages, 84% total support after the messages, and 70-something after we read them the opposition statement. Just a couple more slides left here. I'm just going to briefly touch on some research that was just completed in Southern Oregon. It was commissioned by the Rogue Valley Fire Prevention Cooperative. It was a written survey sent to Ashland, Applegate, Green Springs, and Seven Basins, with 39% to 52% response rate from each community, and there was a repeat in the survey instrument of some of the questions from the National Public Opinion Survey that had been done in 2008. Here you can see about smoke, and actually I circled a bunch of things, so I'm just going to press these so that they appear. I didn't realize how much of a time delay we'd have. Oops, too far. Okay. So first, we asked people to rate, or in the Southern Oregon survey, they asked people to rate how serious smoke from wildfires was, and the four columns represent the different communities, and you can see in the smoke from wildfires, 5% say it's extremely serious in one community, and 43% say it's not serious. A little different response when you ask about smoke from prescribed fire treatment, still 4 to 5% saying it's extremely serious, but 63% saying it's not serious. So people are more willing to tolerate smoke from prescribed fire than they are from wildfires. And finally, a little bit of summary here about the best words being things that, like, reassuring about safety, using words like control and managing, and manage that resonate on an emotional level including people in the picture, tying back to things like Yellowstone, nature-oriented success stories, and having firefighters on the front lines, people who are seen as most credible. And that's my last slide.
Thank you.
Pete, you're coming through very, very garbled, and there are a lot of people who have two phones going at the same time. Could you put your phone on mute so we have less background noise?
The
conference call.
If there's any questions for the group two, we're going to deliberately allocate time to do it. Ask the question, we can see him.
Yeah, I
want to
All
right, Jordan, I think the floor is yours.
Okay. Thanks. So I'm Troy Hall. I'm a professor at the University of Idaho in the Conservation Social Sciences Department. And one of my areas of research is communication. I teach graduate and undergraduate classes in both communication theory and practice. And I have done a lot of work evaluating different kinds of communication campaigns, not necessarily related to smoke, but I'm working on this project funded by the Joint Fire Sciences with my PhD student, Jared Blade. And we are going to talk today about, Jared, you're driving, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll go on to the next slide. We're going to talk about some of the components of the research that we're just getting underway. So we don't have results to talk about, but we're going to talk about the work we plan to do, and we're actually very interested in getting some feedback and some suggestions from anyone on the webinar about some of the components of the work. So I'll talk first about the component dealing with public perceptions and tolerance of smoke, and I think the two presentations to this point really set up well that we have some ideas about what's going on with public perceptions and tolerance, and we know some factors that we think predict tolerance, but we haven't to this point had really extensive or representative data nationwide. So I'll be talking about this survey that we're going to be doing to collect some of those data here in a little bit, and we're also keeping an eye on how we can use the data that we collect there for helping develop some of these communication campaigns. So it was great to hear Laura's work where they've already been testing some of those kinds of ideas. And then Jared's going to talk about two of the other components of our work. One is developing materials for training personnel on some of the human dimensions of smoke. There's several things that we're working on here at the University of Idaho with some of our collaborators. And then Jared's also going to talk about a small component of our work that's funded with the Joint Fire Sciences GRIN money to look at some of the actual communication in public forums with citizens, managers, and scientists related to communicating climate change effects and likely future smoke scenarios. So if we go on, Jared, the first part of our work is looking at how do various kind of cognitive factors and personal characteristics influence public tolerance of smoke and public support for management of fire and fuels. And we based this work on a lot of the similar kinds of things that Sarah was talking about earlier, various theories looking at values and behaviors, understanding that people's values, for instance, for health, influence their what they think about the consequences or they think about burning and then their tolerance to smoke and management. We also built on the risk communication theories that also address values, but some other components about self-efficacy. And then we developed an integrated kind of framework for that we're going to be testing with our questionnaire. So that framework begins with understanding people's basic value orientations, biospheric values like we've been talking about, their support for natural forests, for ecosystem services, and so on. And also the values related to health and property, what we call egoistic values. So understanding that people have a range of strength of values, biospheric and or egoistic. And we think that those values are going to correspond or correlate with specific beliefs that people have about fire, for example, whether fire is going to improve forest health or whether fire is going to adversely affect my health through smoke. So those specific beliefs then influence people's tolerance for smoke, and we think therefore their support for managing different management actions. So we've added to that some other theoretical components from a theory called potential motivation theory that suggests that very specific beliefs are predictive of people's support for management, and those are how vulnerable do they think they are to fire or smoke, how likely is it going to be to happen, and then how severe is it when it does happen. And we've seen some good evidence from the previous two presentations that those factors can vary and may not be very significant for smoke in some cases. And then also people's tolerances and management support are influenced by their feelings of response efficacy, in other words, how effective do they think that a particular action will be. And this gets, again, towards the previous presentations where there's that trust in can it be done safely. So we've integrated those components, and then we've added, we've added some other factors from, and I won't spend a lot of time since Sarah did such a good job of this, trust in agencies for their competence and abilities, and then various individual characteristics that seem to be related towards the tolerance of smoke. So again, as Sarah pointed out, people's knowledge about actions, people's previous experience with fire, and similar to what Sarah said, we're not sure really how that plays out. Is there mixed findings in the literature? We think perhaps Thompson's previous experience may affect people's tolerance. And then an important component that we're building in is looking at whether people are in communities that are urban and affected by smoke versus wildland urban interface communities that are affected by smoke. And I think Laura pointed out that there was some difference in the communities in Southern Oregon about seriousness of smoke, and so maybe some of that has to do with the locations of communities. We are also interested in whether communities that have prepared more for fire, forest management, those kinds of things, have higher levels of tolerance. That seems fairly important from a managerial perspective, and so we stratify the communities on preparedness. Residency status has been looked at as somewhat conflicting findings about whether permanent or seasonal residents are going to be more or less tolerant. So, and then definitely health status, if someone has household members who are have pulmonary issues. So we put those together into this sort of elaborate model that we're planning to test with a mail internet hybrid questionnaire. And we're in the process right now of developing the questions, so we're interested in feedback from anyone about the elements that we might have left off or particular ways that we think we ought to address some of these components. And we don't need to spend a lot of time looking at the specific predicted hypotheses, but we have a variety of hypotheses, and we'll be testing the model through a path analysis approach. We are planning to work in the U.S. Northern Rockies, an area that obviously fire and smoke is a huge issue, and fire seasons are becoming longer up in this area. We have a lot of large fires, a lot of wildfires, and not as much prescribed fire. And we're also proposing to work in the Southeast. At this point, we're thinking about Southeast Texas. We've been talking to folks down in the San Francisco National Forest. And part of the rationale for looking at these two areas is, as Sarah said, that in places where prescribed fire is an established practice, like in the Southeast, there may be higher levels of tolerance, and certainly the fire return intervals in that area are quite frequent. So we haven't completely decided on the Southeast Texas. We're open to suggestions. We've also been thinking about Florida, but Florida's had a lot more research, and there hasn't been a lot done in Texas, so we're kind of leaning that direction. And also, it seems like there's some big issues in the Houston area that would be appropriate. We are planning to select 18 communities, 9 in each region, 3 are urban, 3 wildland urban interface that have been prepared or have developed community wildfire protection plans, and then 3 communities haven't. We're in the process right now of selecting those communities. Jared's been putting together a Delphi process, and anybody on the call who has suggestions, we'd love to hear them, for communities that might be appropriate for us to include in the study. So a large representative sample hopefully will give us some good insight into the consistency of the types of relationships we're seeing and important differences across important variables. Our sampling plan, our target is to get 200 completed questionnaires from each of the communities. We know that response and we've had some success with the mixed mail internet surveys, so we're hoping to use that approach, and we'll do some non-response follow-up because we expect that our response rate will be quite as high as we would like. And I've covered some of the measures that will be included in that theoretical diagram. Another important component there at the bottom is the photo scenario. We're proposing to use a conjoint analysis type of approach where people will compare different visually and verbally represented scenarios, and will vary on important things. For example, Sarah mentioned the length of exposure to smoke. So we'll be asking people to essentially express trade-offs for different components. Are they willing to accept more smoke now for greater forest health long-term? And we haven't decided exactly all of the attributes that we're going to vary in that part of the study, so we're open to suggestions about that as well. I mentioned the analysis. We're going to be comparing the regions and doing some path analysis and regression-type approaches to understand relationships. And then the conjoint analysis will help us determine the relative importance of the different attributes and their levels across the scenarios. So we're hoping to have that component of the research up and running this fall. We'll get the community selected here this summer and finish developing the instruments and be administering that in the fall. And now Jared's going to talk about the other two components of our work.
All right, thanks, Troy. So we'll switch gears a little bit and focus a little bit more on the applied nature of how our research will be used. A big piece of that is training materials. I'm going to talk a little more in depth later in the presentation about the smoke photo series. And all of the information from our survey findings will be incorporated into training sessions, both at the wildland fire training level, but also at the undergraduate and graduate course level here at the University of Idaho. We're also going to coordinate, I've been talking with the Southern Fire Exchange, and I've been working with some folks at Smoke for the Northern Rockies Fire Exchange and the consortia that exist nationwide. And then at the end, I'll focus a little bit on what that Troy mentioned are being put together in combination with the National Science Foundation. In terms of the smoke photo guide, let me just say right up front that Josh Hyde is the man who's been spearheading this effort and deserves all the credit that I'm going to talk about and show you. And if you have any questions or follow-up, please direct them towards Josh and his great work. So what we're really trying to get at here is a visual estimation of air quality through a particular matter in ozone and a variety of other factors. And at the bottom, you see the regions that we're hoping to develop the guide specific to. Let me just change gears here, and I'll show you an example of some examples that Josh has created. This is for Region 5 in California. Starts off with a map showing the purpose and the region that we'll be focusing on. How to use the guide, and what we're trying to control for, and what the tables will be showing in terms of particulate matter, ozone, relative humidity, solar radiation and temperature, and how to use the guide. This photo sets up just a way to orient yourself in terms of which direction you're looking and how distant certain landscape features are. And then it goes into some comparisons in terms of air quality. This is a regular day, and it's showing the parameters at the bottom there in the table. That moves on with a distance marker there of 2.6 miles. Moves on to approaching the air quality standard and what the different features or attributes would look like, and also what the visual representation of that. And then also it shows exceeding the air quality standard with the same shot and what the values would be like in that scenario. Just real quickly, here's another one for the southern region. Similar setup. Shows a photo with distance markers, shows a regular setting, approaching the air quality standard, and then exceeding the air quality standard. So Josh has been doing a great job with those. Another piece that we're working on is incorporating with the NSF IGERT. I'm working with the interdisciplinary team here in the Northern Rockies, and we're working specifically to investigate local climate change effects in the context of hydrology and forest ecology and wildfire. And I'm working as a social scientist on that team, and my piece is going to be how do we take this highly complex scientific information and work with local communities and local collaborators to transition that information from the academic level to the management and the community leader level. And so this really gets at a big management need that everybody has recognized. Rather than serving up a management prescription from the top down, it's working to include a bottom-up perspective and identifying local and community values and concerns and getting the information exchange going both directions towards planning. A big piece of our focus will be visualization and using visual elements to communicate our findings in terms of local climate change and smoke scenarios. A piece of that will be a vulnerability assessment in terms of water availability and forest ecology, forest regeneration, and wildfire risk. Another part will be participatory GIS, or asking participants to actually sit at a station with a GIS user and look at the vulnerability assessment interactively and identify values that exist in current GIS data, or also help to digitize values that they think are not represented spatially. We'll also have them evaluating different mitigation scenarios, potentially in the form of thinning treatments or prescribed burning, and allowing them to work with the boundaries of those treatment areas or suggesting new areas or taking away. And another piece of these workshops is small group deliberation, putting people in small groups of 5 to 10 people and allowing them to talk about everything that they've seen and heard and trying to understand how those group conversations influence their understanding and knowledge and how they process the information. Some of the groups we're planning or we're thinking about working with, collaboratives are a very popular thing nationwide and especially here in the Northwest. The Clearwater Basin in Idaho has a collaborative, the Southwestern Crown Collaborative in Montana, north of Missoula. Pay at Forest Coalition is in central Idaho. And the Kootenai and Idaho Panhandle Forests have been working to develop some group processes that work at landscape level management across boundaries. So those are some of our preliminary ideas of potential participants who want to focus at a collaborative level. Some of the differences is that the Clearwater Basin and the Southwestern Crown have both received national funding for the collaborative forest treatment projects, so they have a large federal funding, whereas the boundaries do not, and so it'll be interesting to do some comparisons there. We'll be doing some pre-post measures of what people know and how the attitudes may have changed regarding climate change effects and mitigation and smoke scenarios before and after our workshop. And then we also want to take a harder look at whenever people are in small groups, how they talk about the topics that we discussed, and trying to tease out how they understand and process information at a conversation level. Some of the other things that will be coming out of our research, we'll have a webpage set up through the FRAMES program, but also through the fire consortium that I mentioned earlier. Similar to Sarah, we've been working on a literature review, and it was really great to hear your presentation because we're heading in a lot of the same directions, and we're going to be coordinating back and forth on that. We'll be presenting posters and referee publications, and those are some of the outlets that you can see there. The Fire Congress and Society of Natural Resources. At that point, I will conclude, and I don't know if you want to do discussion now or wait until later.
Any key questions for anyone who can be part before we get to the park? Next step, Mr. Carter.
Yes, I'm just trying to get the screen up. Okay, I think we're ready. from state in the Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society. And with me today is Danielle Mazzotta, who is one of my graduate students working on this project. And we're going to tag team a little bit on some of these slides. Our lead PI is Eric Tolman out of The Ohio State University, and he's actually over in Australia right now doing some teaching and following up on some potential fire-related research for future work. So I know he wanted to be here today, but we've been working on this project together now for almost a year. Just a quick overview, I want to give you a project description of what we're doing and talk a little bit about our year one method. So this is a three-year project funded by Joint Forest Science with some supplemental funding from the Western Wildlands Environmental Threat Assessment Center, WETAC. And we're in the middle of year one right now, so I'm going to talk primarily about year one and give you some information about the site we've been visiting and some initial reflections from those sites and a little bit about the next steps for this project. So, I was unsure of all the background we were all coming here today with, but I know we're all on the same page about this. From a personal perspective, what really got me interested in doing this smoke research, in addition to Joint Fire Science, explicitly telling us they wanted us to look into this, was I've been working in wildland fire social science research for about 8 years now. I've primarily focused on things about community-agency relationships, communication and fuels reduction strategies, but then looking at the smoke piece and understanding how broad an impact you can have, that it's not just the fire in the immediately adjacent communities, but you can be talking about hundreds of miles in multiple directions. This slide actually came from one of our contacts at one of our site visits that I thought made a really good demonstration of that point. And like a lot of the photos we've seen from all of our presenters today, just understanding that on a day-to-day basis, it can make such a significant impact on health concerns, visual quality concerns, and just enjoyment of life in your local community. So this project description, as I said, is 3 years. Our primary research question, housing communication programs, and fire and fuels-related community partnerships influence public perceptions of smoke management across multiple regions. It is the Otis, Oregon State, Ohio State, the two OSUs, Joint Fire Science, and then that supplemental WETAC funding. This past year, we've done selection of our research locations and have just in the last month completed our site visits, which included interviews that I'll be talking more about. The next year of the project will include some public surveys that are going to be based off of the results we've gotten out of these interviews. And we'll sit down after the public surveys are completed and look at all of the data we've collected at that point, both from interviews and surveys, and doing a big analysis of everything that we've learned, try and synthesize some of those findings, and then bring them back in the third year for what we're calling behavioral experiments. And what we're actually going to do is try to come up with some ideas of new communication strategies or new suggestions on how partnerships might work that either can be applied to all of our sites or to individual ones that have specific characteristics, and then actually take those back to the communities and run some meetings with local individuals, private individuals, federal level managers, any guinea pigs that we can find, and do some little experiments and introduce them to some of these ideas and run some pre-test and post-test questions through them to see if these ideas have made any difference, whether they are appropriate for the location, whether they've changed any opinions or possibly attitudes that may make a difference and be useful for that community to use in the future. So this first year, as I said, what we're doing right now, in choosing our sites, Joint Fire Science had specifically asked for, a variety of locations. They wanted to see some real comparisons between places that were different. So as we sat down to choose where we were going to go, we focused on places that had, you know, large national forests with, you know, internal and surrounding communities that we could go out and talk to people. We wanted to really pick places that had not been overstudied. And this is a growing concern in social science research because our type of research requires that we go out and actually talk to people. It's not measuring trees, but it's talking to people, running interviews, running surveys. And some of the hottest fire locations, no pun intended, in the U.S. have a lot of social science researchers out trying to ask questions. So we wanted to pick places that were not being bombarded as possible. There are so many to choose from, so we were trying to stick with those that were not overstudied. We did not want to pick a place that had a recent major fire event, recent being in the last 1 to 2 years. So we tried to monitor fire seasons over the last year and make those choices this year based on the last few years. And then we, again, are looking for geographic, ecological, and socioeconomic differences. We conducted study structured interviews in these locations. We took a key informant approach where we were going after individuals who we knew would be able to answer the questions that we had, providing the richest information, and then asked those individuals as well if there were others that we should talk to, and that's called a snowball sample approach. So it was a combination of the two. We spoke with agency personnel, being federal, state, and lower-level agencies, timber representatives in some locations, community groups, and some private individuals in some locations. About where we are right now. What we're going to be finishing up for the rest of this year, year one, will conclude at the end of the summer, is all of the analysis. And so when we go out to do interviews, in each case, we take audio recordings of the conversation when we're permitted. And Danielle and another graduate student from Ohio State are working this summer on transcribing and actually typing out verbatim all of those interviews, which is a fairly long process. The next step is then going through those interviews and coding, which is basically reading through and trying to identify keywords that can be matched to different phrases so that you can look at, you know, a multi-page transcript and have a set of keywords and understand the gist of the conversation. And then pulling those together across all of the different interviews within a site and then across sites for looking at major themes. We'll be doing analysis both from a site-specific perspective and from a comparative perspective and looking across all of the different locations. So the four sites, we have been visiting the Kootenai National Forest, northwest of Montana, the Fremont-Wyndham National Forest in south central Oregon, the Shasta-Trinity National Forest in northern California, and the Francis Marion National Forest in south central South Carolina. And I'm going to talk through each of those now. So Fremont-Wyndham National Forest in south central Oregon is just over 2 million acres and primarily forested, a lot of ponderosa pine, lodgepole pine. The main communities in that region are Klamath Falls and Lakeview. And it encompasses a really wide variety of fire return intervals and ecological systems. On the western side, it's bordered by the Cascade Range, including Crater Lake National Park, which is the upper left photo. And then towards the right of the study area, bottom left picture, is the edge of the other edge of the study area where you cross from basically the edge of forest into rangeland into eastern Oregon. And some initial reflections from this site, and so what I really want to impress at this point is that I can't even call these preliminary findings because we haven't finished coding and transcribing our interviews. These are essentially what we can sit down and remember and we've seen from our handwritten notes of some of the most important points. So I'm not even calling them preliminary findings. They're initial reflections. But things that we walked away from each site feeling like, we're going to proudly serve it as some of the most important items. One of the biggest pieces relevant to the Fremont-Wenema National Forest region was that they are in non-attainment status in Klamath Falls, and they are on the verge of being labeled non-attainment in Lakeview. And this is really significant for agency personnel and for individuals because of what it's done to daily air quality concerns, monitoring restrictions and laws, and how it has affected their economy because of the limitations put on new businesses that can come into the area. One of the things that we ask about, related to smoke, of course, is people's interest and ability to apply for strike fire, because that is one of the strongest types of joint furnace science things that he needs us to work on. And the main issue we heard a lot about, especially from private individuals, both industrial and non-industrial, was concerns about liability. And in this case, that has to do with whether or not fires may escape and damage adjacent property. So individuals tended to be very hesitant to use prescribed fire, primarily because of the concern for escape. There was this perception, we heard from a number of people, that the feds can do what they want. And I think that even the feds would sometimes say that to us. So it was not pointing fingers. It was just a recognition that there was conflict and confusion over the different air quality-related rules that different types of people had to adhere to. For example, when Klamath Falls was on a red day for air quality, individuals were not allowed to use their wood stoves to heat their homes. Yet, there were some times when they could, in the distance, see national forest land with pile burning. And so people didn't understand how that could be allowed on the same day. And so there was that perception sometimes that we heard that folks were doing what they wanted. But individuals in town had more significant restrictions. There was a recognized lack of communication, and we heard that across the board from everyone we spoke to, recognizing that they knew they needed to have more opportunities to exchange information, they needed more face-to-face, and that it just wasn't getting done. But everyone had the interest in trying to make that happen. There was a prescribed fire smoke event that had just happened in Lakeview in 2010 that actually provided some really interesting feedback, where it was a prescribed fire, it was not an escape, but it was a significant change in weather on the, I believe, second or third day of the fire, and it caused several weeks of extensive heavy smoke in the Lakeview community, and the after effects of that event, I think, are still unfolding, but it was, say, not a very happy situation for that community. And then finally, heard from a number of folks as well that there are future biomass opportunities in that region and that people are really interested in that because this, the EPA non-attainment status, burning is so restricted. They're looking for other ways to deal with fuels, and there's a lot of excitement about the biomass opportunities. There is a biomass plant currently under construction in Lakeview, and I understand that there has been progress on getting a site and development in Klamath Falls as well. Danny's going to talk for a minute about the next site.
Okay, so the Shasta Trinity National Forest was the site that we most recently visited. This is located in north central California, about 2.1 million acres, both evergreen deciduous tree species here in this area. Just kind of something to note, we really tried within our visit to go to different communities within these forests. And so some of the communities that we visited were smaller than others, and that really lended us the opportunity to get different perspectives from people in these regions. The interesting part about this particular site was the proximity to Redding. And so in that lower left corner, we have just a picture of the highway running through there. There's about 90,000 people there in the Redding region in that city. And so right there in the middle of the Shasta Trinity, we have a fairly large population. Also just a very highly tight area for recreation. There's a lot going on there. National park, state park, and that's a year round recreation opportunity. Again, just kind of touching on what we saw while we were there. A big one was really just expressed concern about the need for better public education of policy. And so there seems to be just basically a disjunct between how people understood the NEPA process and other policy constraints that agencies were under in order to get prescribed fire on the ground. And we heard quite a bit that people feeling like they had their hands tied, so they weren't able to actually utilize the tools that they had to be able to get fire on the ground and to get to gain that acceptance. And this moved beyond just the public agency levels and also made it more into the private commercial sector as well. And so I did talk to some folks from the timber industries up there who also expressed understanding about some of those policies. That was a big one. And then also, you know, within that, a hurdle to some of that communication and some of that education was in the terminology. And so terminology is always changing and some of that. But with that change also, there become some challenges in terms of getting that education out there and being able to disseminate that to the public and to your audience. And liability, the fear of escape, the people feeling unwilling to use prescribed fire as a tool, and that came up with some of our other sites as well. The recreation, and just briefly the recreation in that area. The impact that smoke had on recreation opportunities got brought up a couple different times, and then with that, how that actually affected the economy. So less tourism, less recreation, and then how does that affect the local communities there? And so that was another concern. Also, I guess just worth mentioning right now is the lack of understanding on what a healthy forest should look like. Recreationalists coming in that maybe are not from the area, but also just from the public and the people that live there, not knowing exactly, hey, this is what a healthy forest should look like. This is what it looked like in the past. This is what it looks like now. Those are two very different stories. I had one person in particular mention it's like working in a small box that's surrounded by community. It's very constrained by these urban areas that surrounding these national forests, how that becomes a challenge. Just something worth mentioning that's a positive aspect, they had an airshed coordinating group there of the Northeast Air Alliance. And I thought that was a really good tool that they had in place. They had a standardized information form that the members of this group were able to fill out about their project. And then that information was then shared among the large burners. During the fire season, they had conference calls daily. They could have listservs. And they really utilized that for sharing information. And it was a big trust builder and then also just a really great communication avenue. So I'm going to try to move a little more quickly because I know we're running out of time. But the next slide we visited was, well, one of the next ones, Kootenai National Forest in Montana. Again, close to over a little over 2 million acres. One of the significant points about this site was that in Libby, one of the main communities, that they had they used to have a very strong industry, including several mills. They also used to have a strong mining industry and the world's largest vermiculite mine, which has been turned into a Superfund site, and there are a number of people living in the community that are now compromised, respiratory compromised because of the work that they used to do in that mine. The beach itself is another non-attended site, so that was a significant point that came up in that location in trying to meet the EPA guidelines for air quality throughout the year. As I said, there were health concerns came up as this was probably the site that had the most health concerns that we heard, compounded by that vermiculite mine. And interestingly, we also heard that the agency personnel were in many of the individual places that we visited there actually maintained lists of individuals who had
specific respiratory-related health issues, and when they did have a burn plan, they would actually call and talk to these people. And we heard excellent feedback about that. I'm looking forward to our surveys next year so that we can hear that back from the public individuals as well. But it seemed to be something that was working very well for the community. We did hear from some people some frustration over what they refer to as wasteful burning, because they saw a lot of trees, they saw the need for fuel reduction and the reduction of fire risk, but being historically a suburban location, there was a lot of interest in trying to cut and to create jobs rather than farming. We heard from some folks this idea of trying to scare people into action using photos from some of the worst fire events in the area, or models that would show how serious fires could be, trying to get individuals to treat their own land. This was another location that had a very well-coordinated, well-functioning airship coordinating group, and we heard a lot of positive feedback about that. It involved only the very large burners, but that it was a really good resource that they all took advantage of daily. And this site also expressed interest and possibilities for future biomass opportunities. And the last site that we visited, the Francis Marion National Forest in South Central South Carolina. This one is a much smaller location, around 260,000 acres, and just outside of Charleston, South Carolina. So actually very close to a very large urban region. Something that we heard frequently was a bit of a struggle about the urban population and a perceived lack of knowledge among those in that area who weren't familiar with forestry or weren't familiar with fire. At the same time, recognition that those who aren't familiar with it tend not to interfere as much as well. But it was an issue that surfaced. There were health concerns in this region as well. They have a lot of EPA-required monitoring matters that they have to take into consideration. Ozone tends to be the one that we heard the most about, but particulate matter was not far behind that as well. So getting out into the more rural parts of the region, we heard a lot about how fire is really cultural, and that folks who've been living in the area literally would walk out of their yard in the spring and start tossing matches, because that's what their dad did and that's what their grandpa did, and that they were used to that and comfortable with that, and that's how they treated their own fuel on their private property. We did hear the liability issue come up, and it was really different in this location. Because at this site, it was related to smoke. It was not so much about the escape that we heard in other sites. It was about the smoke, because people were concerned, if I set a fire on my land, I'm going to create this plume of smoke, it's going to go up in the air, and then I'm not going to be able to predict where that goes. Their concern was, it'll sink back down and cause a traffic accident, and then I'll get sued. So it was a really different perspective on the liability thing. And there was actually a movement that's been many years in progress trying to get the state law changed for when someone is determined negligent for using prescribed fire, to make it a little bit more attractive, attempting to make it a little more attractive for individuals to be able to use intentional burning. This one site, I would say, overall, just general impression, was one of the best saw in terms of cooperation among agencies and across boundaries, which we heard from a number of folks in general, just because of how the whole southern region operates, with states being a little bit smaller compared to the west and in closer proximity. Just very quickly, a few cross-cutting issues we saw in all of the locations. We hear this a lot, but it was definitely came up here in our work as well. The need to be open and honest about risks and about what you don't know and when you might know answers to things. We heard the importance of the track record of personnel and how that was difficult to maintain in locations where you had higher turnover. A request from all individuals, agencies, individuals, super folks, for frequent updated information and for clear scientific guidance on what best practices should be. We heard quite a bit about the desire for support, both from agencies and within agencies. The concern and at least the recognition for the hindered economy, something that came up, individuals expressed frustration again, especially with EPA guidelines that would restrict new businesses in the area. And not that, you know, for example, the Forest Service could fix that, but just simply hoping to have recognition that times are tough and that we have to try to move forward together with our restrictions and find a solution. And then, universally, from everyone, we heard that more communication and outreach was needed. And then finally, some internal agency perception. We heard in a number of places about conflicts within or between agencies. One of the best examples, I think, being the large land management agency, you know, needs to burn, needs to refuel versus the air quality limitations posed by the EPA. The need for better communication between agencies also came up in a number of places. Frustration with the lack of consistent messaging from the agencies to the public, and agencies would recognize this as well, saying that we know we can do better, we know we need to do more, and we also think these other agencies are doing a good job or they need to do more, so we heard it from all perspectives. Frustration with the lack of resources, being both, you know, the personnel to do it and the backing from supervisors to accomplish what needed to be done. The perceived lack of understanding for scientific and policy issues among the public. But we did also hear a lot of individuals that were interested in novel ways to communicate. In a few places, they were looking into aging, you know, preschool and elementary school students, knowing that one path to changing attitudes is trying to get the kids who can then teach the parents. And so that's just one example, but we could hear a lot of interest in trying to find new ways because there's the recognition that the traditional old government meeting approach just So finally, our next steps that they can end up continuing now this work. Site reports for all of the interview information we've collected. We finished in the fall and developing mail surveys. Those surveys will be completed next winter, and so by the next summer, we'll have survey finding reports, and then moving into our third year for that experimental approach with new ideas for communication strategies. And I just want to acknowledge some of the other people involved. T.H. Fisher is our federal cooperator, Jeff and Larray are team members, all of our interview participants, and those entities joined by Science, WEPAC, and the Pacific Northwest Station that are responsible for our funding for this work.